The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Everyone hear me all right?
No.
Oh, I'm not. Okay. Yeah, no? Is that okay? So I gave my talk a kind of an interesting title, Suffering With as the Path Through, which sounds like one of those inscrutable Buddhist things that you're going to spend years trying to figure out, but hopefully that won't be the case. Suffering with meaning compassion, just the meaning of compassion. So sometimes Buddhism gets kind of a bad rap. People hear about suffering and they think, man, what a grim thing. And they forget that there's another part to that, which is the cessation of suffering. And I think in my own practice, my own life, I've sometimes forgotten that myself. In fact, sometimes I wish that I were of a different persuasion. Trungpa Rinpoche said something like, better not to start on the path, but once you've started on it, best to finish. And you've all started on the path, in case you didn't know, as well as me. I remember years ago when I was on a long retreat and I was out taking a walk, and I walked by this little church, and there was a big banner in front of it that said something like, you know, enter here and be saved. And there were all these people streaming in, and they were greeting each other, and they were so happy. And I was standing there feeling very lonely and kind of dejected on the side, wishing that I could be welcomed into this community and that I didn't have to go back and sit on a cushion and feel lonely and be with the pain in my legs. And I really, really longed for a different path. But I've learned that there really isn't any going back, and that if I can stay with that longing, with that suffering, with that wishing that things were different, that that actually is the path to salvation, to release. That I too can be like the people in that church, that I can belong, that I can connect, that I can suffer with other people who are having similar experiences. People that are perhaps stuck in the same way as I. We're all stuck in one way or another. So when Mark asked me to speak today, I was really excited because it gives me the opportunity to talk about one of my personal heroes. And that person is Dan Gottlieb. Does anybody know Dan Gottlieb? You do. Okay. I saw a thumbs up. So Dan is a psychologist in Philadelphia, where I lived for 20 years. And 30 years ago, when Dan was 33 and he had a wife and he had two young children and he had a very successful career, he was driving down the Pennsylvania Turnpike in December to pick up a car for his wife. It was their wedding anniversary. And as he was traveling along the turnpike, the big semi in front of him lost a wheel, and it landed on his car. And so that event changed his life irrevocably. So I want to read what he says about that. I was driving up to meet my uncle Irv, who was a car dealer near Harrisburg, to get the car. It was December 20th. I was listening to Donna Summers on my 8-track. Feeling really good, a great sunny day. All I remember is seeing a black thing flying through the air. I saw it for a millisecond before it hit me. The truck wheel from an oncoming tractor trailer hit the top of the car and just flattened the car out. People came around, and the only thing I remember is saying, call everybody I know and tell them to come here right away. That moment I was a quadriplegic. I became in many ways like an infant, and it would take me 8 years to grow up again. So Polly Young Eisendrath, anybody know her? She's a Jungian analyst, and she's a longtime Buddhist practitioner. She wrote this wonderful book called The Resilient Spirit, Transforming Suffering into Insight and Renewal. And she talks about people like Dan Gottlieb, Joanna Macy, other people, some not so well known, and about their experience with suffering and how they transformed it. I know Henry Emmons was here a while ago talking about resilience, so she also speaks of resilience. So this was Dan's description of what followed from that book. I was terribly dependent and ashamed for the first 2 years. I was ashamed that I needed help peeing and cutting my food. I was ashamed of the emotional dependence too. The shame was excruciating, and I began to see that it was optional. So I turned things inside out and began to talk about my dependence and my shame, to address men especially, and say how much strength it required to talk about your weakness. The old Dan began to die as I saw I could help others face their shame and dependence. So this turning things inside out is what the Buddha talks about, paying attention to your own reactions and seeing what kind of reality you are creating out of those reactions. And because Dan had the courage to do that in the midst of his intense suffering, he was able to transform it, as a means to connecting to others, as a way out of his suffering, as a way of connecting with, of suffering with others who were in similar circumstances. And through that, he no longer experienced the isolation or the shame from his condition. So not many of us will not have such a horrific experience with dukkha, hopefully, but we all have our mini versions of it on a daily life. Times that we are encountering our painful emotions, our shame, the things that we don't want to live with or look at. And sometimes when we identify with those, then we make that our reality. It's our small self. I know Mark was talking about that last week. I think I am unworthy, therefore I am. We become our thoughts. And for those of us who are trying to be good Buddhists, whatever that means, we may add to that suffering with the thought that we should be able to transcend all that. We should be able to transcend our painful emotions, our difficult mind states. We treat our own pain, our own emotional and physical pain, as though it were something shameful, as something that we should be beating into submission, trying to control, something shameful. And in fact, it's the opposite is true, that by turning towards, as Dan did, towards his own experience, that that is the way, that that is the path. That making space for all of it, whether we like it or not, whether we're ashamed of it or not, is the path. It's the path of purification. And we do that through meditation and through mindfulness. The longer we practice, the more we see this. And for some of us, we might think, well, why? I mean, I've been practicing here for 15 years. I'm still feeling this. Maybe you have that experience. But as Mark said last week, the deeper layers of holding are often the hardest to see. And so it's like unpeeling that onion as we go deeper and deeper, then we really begin to see the habit patterns. And it's nothing to be ashamed of. And again, this is the path. This is the path of purification. Until we're enlightened, we will have this. So I don't know whether that's the good news or the bad news. So Ajahn Amaro, who is the abbot of Amaravati Monastery in England, he's Ajahn Sumedho's successor, uses the metaphor of cleaning a cooking pot to describe this process. So he says this, when you first put the pot into the water, you haven't started scrubbing, so it doesn't color the water very much. Then you start to scrub and the burn-on gunk starts to float up. You think, this is really murky, this is really bad stuff. But in terms of cleaning the pot, it's natural for that stuff to start to float to the surface. As you start to scrub off the burnt-on, deep-rooted gunk, it changes the nature of the water. What that means is that after you have been practicing for 5 or 10 years, then suddenly you notice these deep layers of attachment, insecurities, desires that you weren't aware were there at all. And you think, gee, all these years have gone by and I should have gotten beyond this by now. This can be deceptive because it was so deeply rooted that it felt normal. It was baked on so hard you didn't even realize it wasn't the pot. It can seem as though we are falling apart or things are degenerating when actually progress is being made. What's arising is the result of getting acquainted with and digging into some deep-rooted identifications and attachments. It's rather like when you get these signs on the highway that a lane is closed, that you have to go south in order to go north, or you need to turn left in order to go right. We know that in Minnesota. The way ahead is backwards. The very fact that a lot of difficult mind states or obstructions are coming up can be one of the signs that you are on the right track, because you are getting into the stuff that has really been creating limitation, burden, and stress in your own heart. You are a good scrubber, really getting some gunk off the pot. So that's the good news. If you're still scrubbing that gunk and it's still showing up, that means you're doing the work. As Leonard Cohen says, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. So anger, fear, hatred, delusion, whatever we have, they're all part of the human condition. They arise and they pass away. And there's nothing to be ashamed of. And as I mentioned, until we're enlightened, they'll be present. Don't take them personally. Don't feed them. But allow them the space to be known, just as Dan allowed the space for his own shame, his own dependence to be known. And through that, then, we can connect with others. We can suffer with. And while you're at it, acknowledge also what's wholesome. Intentionally reflect on your own good qualities, on your own good deeds. Strengthen the neural networks of generosity, of compassion, of that goodness that we all have. The Buddha encouraged us to do that. He said it was very important to reflect on our own generosity, on our own goodness. How many of us allow ourselves to do that? You know, oh, I shouldn't be acknowledging that I have these noble qualities. You know, do it. That is what strengthens the wholesome qualities of mind. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time, we don't have much time, but just maybe 5 minutes, kind of in a group contemplation of that, so that we can water those seeds of kindness and compassion. So if you wouldn't mind closing your eyes again and getting in whatever posture is comfortable for you. And I'd invite you right now to take a moment to consider where in your life your care for others manifests naturally. Does your heart open when you see an elderly or a sick person? Are you saddened by the hunger of those who don't have enough to eat? Do you feel compassion for the physical pain of your parents or the emotional pain of another family member? So take a moment and reflect deeply. How does my generosity, my compassion for others show up? Can I open to that just as I can open to the unwholesome? Contemplate the ways in which you have shared your external or internal gifts with others. the ways in which you have freely offered yourself in the service of friends or family. Remember the ways you've been generous to yourself. Showing yourself the kindness you so generously give to others. And if you're having difficulty even identifying ways that you've been generous to yourself, perhaps that's also part of your practice. How can I cultivate my generosity towards myself, just as I cultivate it towards others? Opening your heart to what is good in yourself and others. So I'm hoping everyone here could find ways that they can connect to their own goodness. You know, in the Tibetan tradition, Mahayana, they talk a lot about Buddha nature, about connecting to your own innate goodness. That's such an important part of our practice. I really encourage you to make it part of your daily practice to recognize the goodness in yourself. Welcome the difficult and the painful emotions so that they can be purified, so that they can be released. But also cultivate the seeds of the wholesome so that they can also grow. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about watering the seeds of goodness. Water those seeds in yourself. Let them be known. So I'd like to end with the words of a practitioner and performance artist in California, Nita Wise. When I began to practice Buddhist meditation, I learned that it presented a methodology for freedom from suffering. I imagined this meant I could manage life's myriad challenges in a state of steady, unmediated bliss. We know that's not true. As my practice deepened, I grew to understand that freedom is not about resting in sublime equanimity, despite the suffering of loved ones and strangers. Freedom is about the willingness to go deeply. Freedom is about the willingness to fall apart. Freedom is about holding on to nothing. And at the heart of the letting go, that dissolution, that surrender, you discover something sublime and unspeakably, heartbreakingly raw. Call it love, call it compassion, call it kindness, call it redemption. Freedom that embraces what is acceptable and rejects what is not freedom. Freedom is wholly democratic. Freedom includes everything. So it includes that shame and dependence, and it includes the beautiful goodness in all of us. So before the children join us and we go out into the blizzard, I'll just open it up to questions or comments.
Yes. I had a wonderful insight while we took that time, just that last 5 minutes, and I had a sister whose birthday is coming up, and it's silly, but too much of my life is on Facebook. Because we had this childhood friend across the street that three of the four of us sisters sort of vied for her attention, because she was so cool. And I was realizing that my sister Lynn doesn't have access to the computer these days, and this wonderful idea to give her address and phone number to Lizzie, so that Lizzie can call her for her birthday and say surprise, and maybe, because we reconnected with her while Lynn was not having access to Facebook. It was such a wonderful idea, such a thoughtful thing to do, and that permission to say this is a good thing to do, I can feel good about it. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. So when we make space for that, it arises. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
This morning, I was reading the New York Times. Polar realization is that some of the, there's some really, obviously really mean spirited political stuff out there, and as I'm reading it, I'm just feeling the pull to react, you know, to my mind, that they can't be Biden. And in the background, there's just this simple, quiet realization that that's just not the way to do it. You know, that if I react, even in my mind as I'm reading this, with an angry backlash, I can't quite describe it. It's just there's this other side of me, and I think it's for my practice course. It's realizing that this just doesn't work. And it was like, God, this is really hard. I mean, I just want to sit back and trust that this is going to be the case. But at the same token, I felt really grounded in that. I don't know how to carry it out. Obviously, I need to make changes. I'll probably screw up tomorrow. but you're the same doing that. It's just a realization, though. I can see these polar things going on here. And it's a little bit what you're talking about, because, you know, I didn't jump over to the reactionary, and I probably will. But there's the bad problem thing. Wisdom or whatever.
And we can make the moment by moment choice to turn the mind in that direction. Right. Thank you. Yes.
I was curious, that last quote that you read talked about giving permission to break down, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle that in a community like this where the norm is absolute silence? If you're going anywhere and you're looking at these things and you have those kinds of emotions.
Mm-hmm. You mean in a meditation hall? That's a really interesting question. I'll answer with a story. I think it's a complicated one because our human instinct is to reach out and console another in distress. So you're talking about someone breaking down in a meditation hall? Is that like you? Okay. Several things come to my mind. One is that I feel like it's a gift when people are vulnerable enough to be able to do that in this kind of setting, so that my heart opens, and that's it's a connection with the suffering of others, the suffering with. So I, as someone who might be in the same room with that person, with you, I would see it personally as almost as a gift that you're giving to me and perhaps the others in sharing that your suffering and your vulnerability. You know, there are, you know, kind of the norm, I guess, is to not, at least in a meditation center, to not reach out to that person. But I think it's kind of an individual thing. If it's somebody that needs just to have a hand placed on them or whatever, then one might do that. I remember being on a really long retreat with a woman who was really, really distraught in the meditation hall. And I remember somebody next to her just putting his hand on her shoulder. It's just a more tangible connection. But I think it doesn't always have to be that tangible. It can be energetic. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I'm hoping that communities like this provide the space for that, that that's okay, that that is part of this process. That's what we're all doing, and some of us may be visibly showing it. Others of us, you know, we've all had the experience thinking everybody else in the room is so calm and serene. You know, it's just me that's going through this torment, but actually probably half of the people in the room are experiencing similar kinds of emotions. So I think this is a space where that can happen, and I hope that it would. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for the metaphor of the pot, because I've had a lot of trouble coming up lately, and I have been doing a little bit of continuous practice for a long time now. And I have never washed a pot that I've criticized it for the company. I really use that metaphor a lot.
That's great. Thank you. Right, we don't criticize our pots for being dirty. Yeah. What else? Yeah.
I have a partial facial paralysis as well as And a couple months ago, I went to the dentist, and the hygienist was cleaning my teeth. And, you know, in my mind, I was like, okay, this person is now responsible for my face because I can't control them. They're going to do anything to me and they have to take care of me. But they didn't know that. So they, you know, so they put the water in, they said do the swish. And anyhow, the person put the water in, she said do the swish, then she turned her back and the water fell out. And normally, my normal reaction would be shame. I mean, you're not supposed to be, you know, dripping out water out of your mouth. So, but anyhow, in, you know, after practicing Buddhism a little bit, I was kind of in the mode of not feeling shame because I was like, well, she didn't realize that this was, you know, my agreement, that she didn't know what to do. So anyhow, so she turned back and she saw water had fallen out and she said, what happened? And I said, well, I have Bell's palsy, so I need your help. And she said, oh, okay. And you know, it occurred to me that something involuntary that I would be ashamed of, and it could be anything, you know, anything that people see or don't see that I feel shame constantly for lots of different reasons. But, you know, just saying that to her, she was like, all right. You know, like, and it just struck me about how many times I feel shame. And the people who can see me or see it or whatever I'm doing, you know, they're like, I don't care. It's okay. And I mean, think about all those wasted moments where I hurt myself with that. That's unnecessary.
By turning it inside.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not sharing it.
Total waste of pain.
And out of that came this insight. So it's beautiful. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
Yesterday I went and went grocery shopping for my mom and a big bird homestead. So yesterday I was talking to him instead of sort of like feeling compassion over myself and like maybe taking some comfort that I did something I didn't want to do and it was a good intention. I was just exhausted by the whole situation. So now today I can sort of look back and like feel like good about doing something good instead of simply focusing on how tired I am and how
awful. Yeah, so water those seeds. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for the experiential piece of reflecting on our goodness. I was really struck by how uncomfortable I was at first, and how it is not something, despite doing this practice for about 6 years now, that is not the path that I've laid down. I'm very much focused, you know, I can see all of the shortcomings and all the ways I need to keep working, and part of that's personality and conditioning and all of these things. So I really appreciate it. It was very powerful. And to think that, okay, if I am actually wanting to cultivate the ability to see the goodness in others, what am I strengthening if I'm not able to see it in myself? So there's a disconnect there. Then you put that together.
Thanks. I've spent years looking at the defilements. It's like, oh, you know, all that gunk in the pot. You know, and it wasn't until recently that I discovered, well, wait a minute, I can turn that, and I can also look at what's wholesome and good in me. So the children aren't here yet, but certainly the children, here they are, would be great, great people to practice this with. So I heard someone was going to leave the chair. Oh, you are good.
The words are on page 44.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, please. Hi.
Thank you.